You're listening to Witch Wednesdays, a semi-weekly podcast source for all things witchcraft in the modern world. Join your host, Steph, on Wednesday mornings to chat about seasons, Sabbats, and all new witchcraft topics to help you make your life more magical. Welcome back to Witch Wednesdays. I'm Steph, and I have a guest author here with me today, among all of the other things that she does. But before we dive into all of that, I am going to go ahead and turn it over to her so she can introduce herself and let you know where you can find her online.
Hello. So my name is Anlyn Avalon. I am a water priestess and Celtic witch. You can find me on Instagram under Anlyn Avalon. It's just like my name is spelled, A-N-N-W-Y-N, Avalon. You can also find me on YouTube, Facebook, and Threads, I believe all under Anlyn Avalon. My websites are waterwitchcraft.com, waterpriestess.com, and then of course you can find everything about me over at anlynavalon.com.
I was going to say, when you find everything about you, you have quite a history in witchcraft as it relates to water, a Celtic background. I'm so impressed with everything that you have been able to do and study, because it is quite a long list.
It is. It's gotten to the point where it's a bit enormous and I have to start picking and choosing like what I actually want to be on there. But my path of magic has been just quite diverse and amazing and lovely. But you know, it's gone through dance, it's gone through fine art, through writing, blogging, YouTube videos. I mean, just so many different things. But the one thing that always connects my work is water.
Which is so interesting to me, because I am a water sun sign, but I am also landlocked. I mean, we do have a giant lake here, but I have read multiple of your books at this point, but your water witchcraft book was really great because it opened so many doors of like, even though you're landlocked and you can't, it would take forever to get to an ocean or a beach, of like all of the different things that you can do and experience, even if you don't have that by you, which was just mind-blowing to me. Totally eye-opening.
I started actually teaching. So I had been connecting with and doing a lot of my solitary work and such for years, but I started actually teaching about water magic when I was living in Arizona. And I had just gotten there. I had just come from living on the coast in North Carolina to the desert. And I really thought that there was no water. Like, I was gonna die. There was like a man-made lake. And I was like, you know, that's just not gonna cut it for me. I don't want some, you know, pond that somebody has dug and filled with rainwater. But the truth of the matter is, there's actually water everywhere, even in Arizona. I started like really like diving deep and being like, where can I find water in the desert? And Tucson, Arizona has waterfalls. There's a hot springs right outside of Phoenix, Arizona. About 2.5 hours north of Phoenix is a place called Sedona, which I'm sure many of you have heard about. There are sacred wells, there are sacred springs, there are creeks and rivers. Cottonwoods, not too far from there as well, also has a ton of water. Flagstaff also has a lot of water. Of course, they were in northern Arizona, which isn't so deserty. But even there's a river that runs right through Arizona, like right through Phoenix and that area, the outskirts of it. So there's water everywhere. So, you know, for people that are landlocked, I encourage you to dive a little deeper, because even in Arizona, there was water. But I also understand, because going from living next to the ocean to the desert was so hard. It was so hard. But you know, we can use the water in our tap, in our bathtub, to create magic. So there's so many ways to connect with water.
I'm so excited that you said Arizona. I was like, that's even less water than it's here in Chicago, which is absolutely amazing. So I love that you offered that resource and have begun teaching about that, because it's obviously one of my favorite elements to work with. I tend to favor water witchcraft. So I love that that resource exists because I know that some people kind of struggle with that. So thank you for providing that.
Of course, my pleasure.
And how did all of your work and history lead you into studying more of Celtic background? And specifically, how did you incorporate all of the Celtic goddesses? Because I would love to talk about your other book.
Yes, my newest book that just
Yes.
came out.
Very, very exciting. And another one that I learned so much from, because I think there's like a lot of emphasis on particular Celtic goddesses. And I learned so many new names just from reading this book. I was like, I didn't even know these existed.
Well, there's so many, and I know that I missed some. Like when I first started writing the book, I was like, I will have every Celtic goddess ever in this book, and it was impossible to put them all in there. So I know that I've even missed some. But oh my gosh. All right, so to answer your question, how did I get started on the Celtic path and with Celtic goddesses? Well, it's a long story, but the very, very short version, I'll try to keep it short here, is so my mother was born here in England and moved to the US when she was in her late teens, early 20s, and so I was born with UK citizenship, with English citizenship, but when we were growing up, we would come over, not every summer, but some summers. And it was always so important to me. It was such a big thing and it was so impactful. And I just really would connect with all of these places. Like, for example, Sulis's temple at Bath. I went there when I was 5, and then again when I was like 12, and then 16, and over and over and over again. And then, into my adulthood, I kept going back. So it was like this place that I would pilgrimage to, even though at the time I wasn't calling it a pilgrimage. It was like family vacation. And then there's other goddesses in the book that started coming to me later on when I first started working. With when I first started my magical practice, I started working with bodies of water, I started working with spirits, and almost all of the spirits that came through were either watery or had some sort of like Celtic connection. As I got like older, I went going through my, teen years into my early 20s, I became obsessed with like all things Celtic, medieval. I got into some reenactment in my like really early late teens, early 20s. I was into some of the reenactment stuff. And I just was so obsessed with it. It was like this drive. And I would draw these spirals and these triskels and these triquetras over and over and over again until finally I really did like actually start researching and learning what all of this was, and everything brought me back to my, connection to the British Isles and to, the my family's connection, my ancestry. Not that that really, makes a difference for other folks. Like, you don't have to, have been, your mother doesn't have to have been born in the UK to work with a Celtic goddess. But for me, like, that was a big driving point. It was part of who I was, and I wanted to know that. I did have some in the early days. Some of the Greek goddesses did come in. and some of the Roman, like Greek/Roman goddesses did come in, Aphrodite and Persephone and such. And I did work with them and I still honor them. But not in the same way that I work with and honor some of the Celtic goddesses. But there's also an interesting connection with the Romans and the Celts, because the Romans were the colonizers of the Celts. They came over and they, you know, built their temples on all the sacred sites, both destroying and preserving a lot of the Celtic ways. And then after that, it was the Christian occupation that, again, they built their churches on the sacred sites and also destroyed and helped to preserve some of these older practices. I really started getting into folklore around sacred wells and springs and some of the practices around different bodies of water, like rivers and lakes. And what I kept finding was that every single body of water had a connection to a spirit or a goddess or a saint. And then that saint would have a connection to a goddess. And when I wrote Water Witchcraft, it was a bit broader. And then it was really narrowed down into, you know, Celtic water, like folk magic around water. And you'll see some of the goddesses in there. But when I wrote that book, it was my first book and it was huge. It was like twice, maybe three times the size of what got published. And so I had to kind of split it up and chunk things out. And so about 30,000 words went into my second book, which is The Way of the Water Priestess. And then I had big chunks and swaths of leftover goddesses that just didn't make it in. Like Sulis made it into Water Witchcraft, and so did Melusine, and so did the Lake Lady, but in a smaller way, like in a much smaller capacity. And so I got to work on this third book and start putting the goddesses, you know, expanding them and talking about them in a greater capacity. And then, like you had mentioned just a little while ago, that, you know, that there was obscure goddesses and goddesses that you've never heard of. So when you're writing a book on Celtic goddesses, it takes you on a really deep dive, and you start out with the ones that you think you know. It just kept getting deeper and deeper. And then I found that I needed three times as many, you know, words to write the Celtic goddess grimoire as what actually got published. So there's a lot that got cut out as well, because there's so much information. But what did get included is all the really good stuff. I made sure that was, you know, it was nice, and all the really important good stuff got in there. But then I also had to make hard decisions, because you know, there are tons of books on the Morrigan, there are tons of books on Bridget, there's several books on Ceridwen. And you cannot write a book about Celtic goddesses and not include those goddesses. That would be ridiculous. But at the same time, there's multiple volumes that multiple authors have written about these goddesses. And so I really wanted to make sure that they were included, but I also wanted some of these more obscure goddesses that don't have full books on them, or may never have full books on them, to kind of be highlighted and shown, you know, shine a light on them, and to really say, like, hey, there's a lot more. So Coventina gets a little bit, and Arnamentia, she also gets a big chunk, and Nematona and Rosmerta and some of these other goddesses that are just not as well known, but they had a huge following in the ancient world, and they were worshipped in many locations, because we keep finding the artifacts. We keep finding them in the archaeological record. And then, of course, water plays a huge part in this book as well, too, because the Celtic goddesses are deeply connected to water. Many of them are named for rivers, or the rivers are named for them. Many of them are connected with holy wells or the ocean or, you know, particular lakes. Like Ceridwen is connected with Lake Bala, and the Lady of Llyn y Fanfach, or the Lake Lady, is connected with Llyn y Fanfach. You know, even Rhiannon has a connection with water, which comes from Adair Rhiannon, which are Rhiannon's birds, which are located out in the ocean. I believe the only goddess that didn't have a connection to water that I could find was Andraste. And the reason for that is because all that we know about Andraste comes from what we know about Boudica and Queen Boudica. And what we know about Queen Boudica comes from the letters home to Rome. So what the Romans were writing back, or the Roman generals and such were writing back to Caesar. And so there's, that's all we have. So Andraste might have been connected with a body of water, but we'll never know because we've lost that information. I'm trying to think if there's any other goddesses that weren't connected. Like, even goddesses that you wouldn't think are connected with water are somehow connected with water. Like, Blood Iwith. Like, for the longest time, I was like, oh, obviously she's a flower goddess, not a water goddess. But there is a part in her story where a river, she has to, you know, a river takes place, a river comes up twice in her story, and some of the pivotal moments in her story take place at these rivers. So I was a little shocked about that and was like, there's more water. So lots of water. Water led the way on this one. I'll pause there. I think I've side quested twice from the question that you asked me. So
I love the side questing because it just connects your story so beautifully of how the dive into the goddesses actually happened. And I love that so many of them are connected to water in that way. And it's part of what I learned so much through your book. And something specifically that I loved was like the breadth of information that was in there, because I am completely in love with history and the folklore and the mythology and where all of that comes from. Because I think in modern day witchcraft, we know that so much of what we know and do was influenced by Wicca, which was heavily influenced by UK based sort of witchcraft and a lot of Celtic beliefs and systems. So I just loved reading through that and like getting to know all of that history. And I can't imagine how much you must have researched for this and also how much you had to cut out. I'm like, I just want more. I want a bigger book.
Oh, I know. I would love to have you know, written a bigger book. And I've kind of joked a little bit around, you know, maybe there will be a number two. But this book was so hard to write. My first book was really hard to write, I'm not going to lie, because it was my first one and I had no idea what I was doing. My second book, The Way of the Water Priestess, it flew right out of me, no problem. But Celtic Goddess Grimoire was so difficult because I wanted to just put so much information about each of the goddesses in there. But unfortunately, there isn't an equal amount of information about them. And it's really disproportionate. So, for example, we have the Welsh goddesses like Rhiannon, Blood Iwith, and Arianrhod that get full stories in the Mabinogi. Same with the Lake Lady and Ceridwen, like they're full stories, and some of the Irish goddesses as well. They get these big, long sagas, which tell us so much about them. And then you have goddesses like Arnamentiae and Sulis and Coventina and Rosmerta and Epona that there's no stories. zero stories, zero text that talks about them. There's no fragments of their story or their legend. But what we do have is a massive amount of archaeological evidence. So Sulis, of course, so I have a deep connection with Sulis. Well, let's talk about her a little bit. Sulis,
excellent, let's
is,
do it.
she's like a perfect example of one of these goddesses that has a massive amount of archaeological evidence for her existence and her worship across multiple different like cultures and times, but zero stories. There's one legend that does talk about Sulis. I didn't put this in the book because again, space. But it doesn't really talk about Sulis as a goddess. It only talks about the water. And it's about King Blod, and he had leprosy, and he went and like saw these pigs kind of rolling around in the mud near the sacred spring that was bubbling up, and he decided he would do the same, and then his leprosy was cured. So again, we have a story about the site, but not about the goddess. So then we get, fast forward to the Regency Georgian Victorian periods, where they are starting to do all of these excavations and archaeological digs, and it's fancy, and all of the aristocrats are going to Bath to take the waters. Well, during this period, when all the aristocrats going and taking the waters, this is still using her sacred waters for therapeutic reasons, for healing. But they start digging and they start finding all of these Roman artifacts. And now what we have is a almost fully excavated temple about 22 miles north of where I'm at right now, in a place called Bath, here in England. And it is this huge temple complex. They've turned it into a museum. You can go in there and spend half a day just walking through, looking at all of the artifacts, looking at the offerings that were given to her, looking at all of these curse tablets that were placed in the water, looking at the altar stones that were dedicated to her and other stones that have her name written on them, giving us this evidence and saying, like, look, this goddess was really, really important, not only to the Romans, but to the Celts as well, because of course the Celts were worshiping Sulis at this site long before the Romans showed up. When the Romans did show up, they built this gigantic temple complex, which, I mean, the Romans built a lot of things and they did build a lot of big things, but to have a huge temple complex for a Celtic goddess is a bit odd. It's just slightly out of place. It's true that they would come into new areas and that they would like find the local deities and kind of be like, oh, like that goddess is kind of like Diana, so we're gonna call her Diana. Or this one is kind of like Minerva, so we're gonna call her Minerva. But with Sulis, what they did is the Romans showed up and she was so sacred and so powerful and so important to the Romans that they decided not only to not rename her and let her keep her name, Sulis, but they tacked Minerva onto the end, so Sulis Minerva, but then they built this gigantic temple complex to her. And we have like no stories. We don't know what Sulis's origin story was. We can look at her name and learn that it's possible that she has connections to the sun or connections to eye, like an eye or the eye of the sun. We know that she's a hot spring goddess with her thermal waters bubbling up and is a healing, it's not only is it a healing spring for the Celts and the Romans, but it was for the later aristocrats, and it still is today, because you can actually go to Bath and you can go to a place called Therme Spa, which is like a modern day spa experience, but they've taken the water from the spring and they've pumped it into this modern spa experience where you can go and get, you know, just do steam rooms and you know, float in pools and all sorts of stuff. So her worship has been for thousands of years across so many different occupations and of the Celtic lands, even to the point where there's a beautiful cathedral built on top of where the Roman baths were. So it, you know, the Celts worshipped first, then it was the Romans, then, you know, this beautiful cathedral is built on top of that, then it continues with the aristocrats coming to drink the water to heal. But we also know then from her artifacts and from what's found in the temple that she wasn't just a goddess of healing, but she's a goddess of cursing and of justice. And there was about 150 curse tablets found in the archaeological digs, and who knows, maybe we'll find some more. But it was, you know, such and such has stolen my tunic, please, or great goddess Sulis, I implore you to, you know, never let them sleep until it's been returned. and things like this. And so it's so fascinating. I had a pretty profound experience with her in 2018, when I was there in Bath. And since then, I call her my goddess. She is my goddess. I've always worked with and honored the divine feminine, but she is number one.
It is amazing. What beautiful history to have and to be near. And I have multiple follow-up in comments. But first follow-up comment that I wanted to say, in addition to all this like beautiful history, you are very detailed in the book with having exercises for people that are just getting started and might be overwhelmed by all the names that you've given so far in this episode. And I just want to say that your book is incredibly helpful. You have an exercise of starting and finding a goddess to work with. So I just want people to know that that information is also in your book. So you do not have to know any of this before you start reading.
Thank you for pointing that out. Yes, you start and you end with the same vision journey, or visualization or meditation, where you go into the standing stones, and you look into a scrying pool and she comes to you, and a goddess comes to you in the very beginning, before you open before you get into the chapters about the goddesses. And you're supposed to take notes of like, what does she look like? What does she say to you? Like, what is in the background? What do her clothes look like? What kind of energy does she have? So that the goddess that might be wanting to work with you, or that has been tapping your shoulder for years and years, or patiently waiting silently for you to notice, comes to you. And then you read the rest of the book, and hopefully she's revealed. And then you visit the standing stones again at the very end. You go back to the beginning, and you kind of can redo the vision, and see if things change or if it becomes more clear for you. So
yeah, because I have a great exercise, and you have multiple exercises throughout the book that would be helpful and, you know, ideas for getting started. So you don't have to know any of this, because I was like a lot of, I think, beginner readers, where I was familiar with Bridget Carrigan and the Morgan, just like you said. And I, beyond that, I just did not have that much information. And I feel like I learned so much without getting overwhelmed.
Right. Well, and it can be super overwhelming. And see, I was not the type I would always envy like the Bridget devotees or the Morrigan devotees, because the goddesses would come to them and it was so clear that who it was. That is obviously the Morrigan that came to you in a dream. That is obviously Bridget that came to you in your meditation. And it was so easy. But the goddesses and the spirits that were coming to me weren't that, I couldn't just open up, you know, Google, and maybe at that time, I don't even know if Google was around in the same capacity, but, you know, I couldn't just open up the internet or a book and be like, oh, boom, that's who it is. It was obscure goddesses like Sulis or like the Lake Lady from the Mabinogi, because I had lake ladies coming to me, but they were not the Arthurian sword wielding or sword handing out lake ladies. They were something different. They were very watery, very fairy woman like, which, yes, of course, the Arthurian lady is a fairy woman as well, but you'd expect a lake lady to be handing you a sword, and mine were swordless. And so that gave me a clue that they were different. Or the two-tailed mermaid that kept showing up. And again, like, that is super weird because mermaids usually don't have two tails, until I started really diving deep and trying to figure out what are these spirits that keep coming to me. And so there's others out there like that as well, that, you know, you might have a spirit come to you or a goddess come to you, and you're just like, I have no idea who you are. Or they might tell you their name. Arnamentia was one that came to me and told me who her name was. Like, she told me her name. And I think that when, at that time, I think this was probably the early 2000s, there wasn't a Wikipedia page on her. You know, I had no idea who she was. There was nothing I could find. So it was partially like my quest to find out who they were that helped to lay the foundation for the book.
And I'm glad that you wrote it, because now I have some place to check in, like, myself and look all this up, because you're right. This is not a place on the internet for this information, where you can readily find a lot of these smaller goddesses. So I'm glad that this exists. And the other follow-up, I guess it's just about your life, but you mentioned, you know, it being 20 minutes north of where you are and Sacred Springs, and I would love for you to let the listeners know where it is actually that you live and what you do besides being an author and sharing all of this great information.
So, if we had done this interview way back in 2021, it would be a very different tale to tell. But it is now 2024. How time flies.
Oh.
And I moved from the US to Glastonbury, England, about a year and a half ago, fall of 2022, yes, the fall of 2022, November of 2022. I had to think about it for a second. I moved very fast. It was a very fast move to Glastonbury. And so I live now in Glastonbury at the base of the Tor, across from the Chalice Well, next to the White Spring. And some of the listeners may have heard of the famous occultist from the 1920s, 30s, and 40s named Dionne Fortune. She wrote Moon Magic and The Sea Priestess and books on the Kabbalah and Glastonbury of the Heart. She was quite a prolific writer and very, very famous in some circles. And I purchased the cottage that used to be hers here in Glastonbury, and I'm restoring it. I also am a what we call a keeper, which is like a volunteer or someone on staff. We don't get paid, we're volunteers, and because it's a community run spring. Let me back up. The White Spring is a free entry, volunteer run interfaith water temple, with lots of amazing shrines. And I, as soon as I got here, started volunteering here at that spring because I have a long history with it. It has changed my life multiple times. It's where I was told to start teaching about water magic. and which is what ended up being the foundation for my first book. It's I was in that spring again on pilgrimage in 2018 when I kind of got the, like, you know, fly forward with The Way of the Water Priestess. It's time to publish this. And it was also a pivotal moment in the spring of 2022 when I audibly heard in meditation inside the temple that I would be moving to Glastonbury before 2023. Didn't believe it. I thought it was impossible. But as soon as I got here, I was like, the spring has changed my life, not once, not twice, but three times now. And I would really like to volunteer. And it just started out with, you know, like a couple of hours a week. And then by last summer, I was doing 2 days a week anywhere. And there's two, like I was doing two shifts a week, plus cleaning it, plus, you know, Sabbats and such. So I was spending anywhere from 12 to 30 hours a week at the spring. And then by the fall, the lead ceremonialist retired and I took over that position. And so now I'm not only a keeper volunteer, but I'm also the lead ceremonialist at the spring. And we do the eight Sabbats or the Wheel of the Year community rituals at the spring. For not just the local community, because Glastonbury is, and like, it is a local community. There's a lot of local folks here, of course, because people live here just like I do, but it's also a bigger part of the international community because it's a pilgrimage site. So people are coming constantly from everywhere in the world to Glastonbury in order to connect with the sacred springs, walk the tour. There's priestess trainings, there's esoteric conferences, there's so many amazing things that you can do in Glastonbury. So anyways, I host the rituals for the local and the international community, whoever's in town visiting and on their sacred pilgrimage. So I started my very first ritual at the spring was Samhain of 2023. We have a lovely, I'm going to circle it back to goddesses now, because on Imbolc, we have a lovely ritual where a little girl comes, she trains on how to make fire from straw and flint. And so she comes that morning dressed up as the embodiment of the maiden form of Bridget, which we call Bridie. And on Imbolc morning, she goes into the courtyard garden and about 200 people pack inside of this old well house. And we black it out so that there's not a pin prick of light shining through. And while we're all in there, in the dark womb of the mother, meditating and being really uncomfortable, she is out in the courtyard as the embodiment of the goddess, and she creates a flame from flint and straw. And she carries that in to the temple. She comes to the front doors and she bangs, bangs on it, bang, bang, bang. And we fling the doors open and we welcome the goddess in, and she parades the flame down where she brings it kind of to where the center pool is. And from that single flame, we light about 200 to 300 candles. And we bring ourselves out of the darkness. Now, what's really amazing about this is that flame is then kept for an entire year. It's a yearly perpetual flame. And we never have lighters in the spring. We never go around with a lighter and light candles. We keep that flame, two perpetual flames going in the spring, one for a backup. And every time that we go in to light the temple, we pull that flame and we light the temple from that flame. So every candle that's lit today or yesterday, I was on shift yesterday, was the flame that was created on February 1st. We also have a beautiful statue of the maiden form of Bridie, as well as what we call a bower. The bower is like a woven archway tunnel that is made once every 3 years, and it's made out of hazel branches, which is a deep connection with hazels and the well of wisdom and sacred wells. And so we create, and of course, in bulk, because that's when the catkins start to kind of bloom. And so we create this beautiful bower, and it's just people come from all over the world, and they tie ribbons and prayers and spells and little dolls that they make and little, you know, little embroidered things, and the god dies, which are, you know, like you take the two sticks and you make a cross, and then you weave the yarn around and around and around until it creates that really beautiful colored like shape that sometimes they call God's eyes. Those are hung in there. Bridie's crosses are made out of rushes. Those are hung in there. And really, this is an amazing, breathtaking away. I mean, it just takes your breath away when you come into the temple for the first time. Place, and it transformed my life so many times, and I know that so many others have been transformed by its mystical healing powers. But for those that might be listening, if ever you're in Glastonbury, make sure you come to the White Spring and come into the White Spring Temple. And we've got it's just this water just flowing through with shrines, not just to Bridie or Bridget. We've got the Black Madonna, as well as a solar shrine, and then the Fairy King of Avalon. But anyways, it's quite a magical space. So I volunteer there, and yeah.
Thank you for sharing. That sounds so beautiful.
Yeah, it'll take your breath away for sure.
Well, I appreciate you sharing everything that you do, because I think that that is like a really fun and important part of your story and your history and just where you are now. I think that's amazing. Some place that I always want to visit, but I don't fly, so that won't happen. But I will just live vicariously through you and everything that you share.
Yeah, airplanes can be quite harrowing. I will say that now that I'm here, I'm really happy that I don't have to get on one to come here. I'm here and I just
and you're staying.
Staying. Exactly.
Well, thank you so much for being here today and sharing all about your books and your history and your knowledge. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat about everything that we covered today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
And listeners, I am going to have everything linked in the show notes as always. You can check out whichwednesdays.com and find everything that you're looking for, the websites, Instagram, the books, everything that you could possibly want will be linked there. And that's everything that I have for you this week. I will see you in the next one. Need even more witchcraft in your life? Subscribe to Witch Wednesdays on Patreon and YouTube for all types of exclusive bonus content like spells, recipes, book reviews, and more, or even order personalized tarot readings and spells. Be sure to follow on Instagram at Witch Wednesdays Podcast. And you can find all these links and more at witchwednesdays.com.